Well, we are really excited to have Bill Malone with us here today. Bill's a lifelong fan of country music, a music historian of country music, and he literally wrote the book on country music published in 1968 titled Country Music USA, and the 50th anniversary edition of that book came out last year. Bill was a consultant for and appeared on Ken Burns' documentary series Country Music, which was a fantastic piece of film work, and Bill was wonderful on it. And in 2008, he received a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Society for American Music, and he hosts a country music show on WORT in Madison called Back to the Country, which airs every Wednesday morning, 9 a.m. to noon on 89.9 FM in Madison. Welcome, Bill.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Oh, really glad to be here.
Wow, we're very excited to have you here today. And I guess, you know, because so many people now know you from being on Ken Burns' documentary. Could tell us a little bit about what that was like when you were filming that.
Oh, well, it was a thrill of a lifetime. You know, I read scripts for them, and then I appeared on camera. They interviewed me for about 3.5 hours, and they took bits and pieces, you know, and put them in the different episodes. And we saw rough cuts of all the episodes, different consultants and spouses sat around and watch the entire thing. Then after each episode, then we would make input. We would tell them what we thought and what we thought should be cut out, what should be improved, mistakes. And that little period of time was just about the most exciting time I've ever spent, you know, just to see all that great footage and be able to talk about it to people who had an interest in it like I did.
Well, it's interesting you should say the other consultants, because you were the only person who wasn't like a professional full-time country music musician on the film.
Yeah. I was the only professional historian.
Yeah.
And they had consultants from the music industry music journalism, that sort of thing, but I was the only academic historian. And, of course, they used my book, Country Music USA, as a sort of context for what they did.
Yeah, no, I really enjoyed watching the series, and I enjoyed you being on that.
Thank you.
And what was interesting to me, because again, I'm not a music historian nor a historian of country music, was how, and I kind of knew this anyway, but how there was a common root, if you will, for what we think of as folk music and what now is called country music. I mean, back in the day, in the early part of the 20th century, it was called hillbilly music. But that wasn't necessarily the name, obviously, it kept. But there was a lot of commonality between what we think of as two different genres today, mm-hmm. wasn't there?
Well, I think your listeners probably won't know that until the 1920s, there was no entity in American entertainment or popular culture that was called folk music. Mm-hmm. Now, professional musicians, people from vaudeville or blackface minstrelsy would sometimes do a folk song. They might play a fiddle tune or do an old ballad or a love song, something like that. But there was no organized body of music presented to the public under the name folk music. But what happened in the 1920s was that sort of coincidentally, the recording and radio industries of the United States began tapping into the widespread performance of grassroots music. They started recording fiddlers and string bands and ballad singers and gospel singers, Hawaiian bands, that sort of thing. And it was out of this commercial exploitation that what we now call country music emerged, first called by different names by the recording companies, but then hillbilly caught on and lasted at least through World War II. And the music at that time, from say 1922 or 1923 on up into the 30s, it was folk in every respect. The music that people did is music that they grew up with for the most part. They'd heard around home or in church, or if they were an itinerant musician, they would pick up a song that way or at a fiddle contest. And the songs and the styles in which they were performed were traditional. They were what people had grown up with and what they had learned from previous generations. So as I said, the music at that time although given these different names for commercial purposes, for marketing purposes, was folk in every respect.
So, like, when you think back to those musicians around this time period, what are some examples of some songs that you think of that we might think of as folk, but really is sort of a common rootstock for both these types of music?
I think a song which is really illustrative, because not only does it present a song that's probably a couple of hundred years old when it was done, but it's performed in a style that had been passed on from generation to generation, and it also evokes the context in which the music performed. I'm thinking of a song like Soldier's Joy, an old British fiddle tune performed by Gid Tanner and the Skillet Lickers. And right before they start playing the song, I think it's Clayton McMitchin, one of the fiddlers, he said, "Mama, you just, these are not the exact words. You can tell when the record plays what he says, but he's telling her to pull the carpet back and pull the furniture back, because we're going to kick up our heels now and we're just liable to mess it. We don't want to mess things up."
Yeah.
Then they go into the song.
Yeah.
And another good example would be a traditional ballad, one that made the transit across the Atlantic. Not all songs did. The music came from everywhere. It came from African-American sources. It came from the church. Some of it was written by the performers themselves, by traveling evangelists or blind street singers or balladeers, people who would go into a county seat on market day, or they would go onto a train down at the train station, and they would go up and down the aisle singing the most recent song they had written and hoping somebody would buy a copy of it. So the songs came from everywhere, but some of them did come as part of the cultural baggage of people who came from Great Britain and other parts of Europe.
Sure.
And a good example of that, and again, this song is illustrative of more than just one thing. It's a song performed by a Baptist preacher. He wasn't a preacher at the time. He was just studying to be a Baptist preacher. His name was Buell Kazee, K-A-Z-E-E. And he played the banjo in a very haunting, loping style. And it's really nice to hear him singing those long hell notes of the ballad, this song of suicide, this young woman who takes her life because the butcher's boy will not be true to her. And it's just a great effect to hear the song being sung in this mournful way with that kind of a loping banjo style in the background. Then another source was, of course, with the church. Religious music and secular music are interrelated from the very beginning. A lot of the singing styles that people possessed, a lot of the songs they loved, came from the church or from a church-related function. It came from a singing school or a camp meeting or some sort of religious revival. Those songs endured and were handed down. And a good example of that was a song performed by another Baptist minister named Alfred Carnes from Eastern Kentucky, just like Buell Kazee was. Alfred Carnes traveled from one church to another each Sunday, sort of like a circuit preacher. We generally associate that with Methodist, but the Baptists seem to have done it too. And he played the guitar in a dynamic ragtime style. And what we'll hear is him doing an old song called "I Am Bound for the Promised Land," which he does in ragtime style. I like to pick these songs out because, you know, we can learn two or three things at once. We get a good idea of his singing style, his dynamic guitar picking, but we all also learn that people experimented with the songs. He came up with a melody and with something that would be appealing to people. And when you put it in a ragtime eight-to-the-bar style, you can see why it might be exciting to folks. He's telling the age-old story of the pilgrim's progress across the world, but aiming for that ultimate reward in heaven. I am bound for the promised land. Oh, who will come and go with me?
Well, it's interesting. You can see why they, at least initially back in the early part of the 20th century, used the term hillbilly, because I'm thinking your examples of drawing a lot from Eastern Kentucky and the mountains there. I'm thinking about the Carter family and Jimmie Rodgers coming
from the Mississippi uplands.
But if you fast forward a little bit, you start to see influences from other parts of the country coming in to the music. And what I'm thinking about is, I just found this really fascinating. In the country music documentary, you know, Marty Stewart making a comment that Woody Guthrie was a country artist, but the country community didn't embrace him, and the folk community did. And there you go. It seems like there's so much overlap between those.
I think Woody started something new in American music. I'll give him more credit. Anybody else, I don't know that we should really go that far. But he went to New York in about 1940 and became part of the radical community there, singing his music in order to promote social change. And that brought people like Pete Seeger into the performance. So I think what Woody did was to establish the idea of the traveling balladeer with a social conscience. And so there in New York City, what soon began to be called folk music developed because of what Woody and others like him, Lead Belly, for example, who came up from Texas, Louisiana. And so in a sense, then Woody and those people began to separate themselves from commercial country music or from hillbilly. And that separation has endured down through the years. But I think of folk music, as we generally use the term, was really a kind of a singer-songwriter phenomenon. So many of the people who do what they call folk music nowadays are singer-songwriters. But to me, I can't understand what the difference is between them and, say, Merle Haggard, who also wrote his own songs.
Yeah.
And sometimes it had a social message that we might not necessarily like, but nevertheless, he was embodying the very old tradition of ballad making.
Sure. Well, I think of Johnny Cash as another example who really kind of straddles that. Well, there's probably in the genre of music in the U.S. today that doesn't claim Johnny Cash a little bit.
Right. So. And he knew that. He was a master at self-promotion.
Yeah.
You know, when he was one of the first country western musicians to appear at the Newport Folk Festival, then he made a very close and lasting friendship with Bob Dylan. Bob came on Johnny's television show, and Johnny Cash was the first person in country music, I think, one of the first anyway, who was promoted in Rolling Stone magazine. He began to build a youthful audience that stayed with him over the years. I think more than any other country singer, he was able to keep his feet in different camps. He maintained the loyalty of the country audience that he grew up with, but he also tapped into the rock and roll audience and to the urban folk audience, and he just better than anybody ever had before or since, probably.
Yeah.
Willie Nelson may be challenging that role now.
Yeah. So we've kind of sort of quick zip through history, kind of moved ourselves up into the folk revival of the 60s and 70s. Talk about Bob Dylan, for example. So that's another period where we kind of see, and you mentioned Johnny Cash and Bob Dylan sort of coming together. That's another period where we see a little bit of a crossover.
Mm-hmm.
The distinctions at least in marketing are there more than they were in the early days. So what was happening in this time period that...
We were speaking earlier about the Kingston Trio. You know, they came up with that blockbuster hit, Tom Dooley, in 1958. And that was an old hillbilly song. It was first recorded in a little bit faster, a little bit different words, but basically the same song, recorded by G.B. Grayson and Henry Witter back in about 1929 or 1930. It's a commercial hillbilly record. And then, like so many of those songs, it moved out among the people. It was taken over by various singers. And it became a, quote, folk song, unquote, in that it lost its original identity, lost its authorship. But anyway, the Kingston Trio were such a big hit with that song that they brought droves of young people into the performance of music similar to that. And that, for a few years, that was the big genre in American music, and certainly influenced the music being made by country performers. And I think one of the a very good example of that was the great song written by two Nashville songwriters, Mary John Wilkin and Danny Dill, a song called The Long Black Veil, recorded by Lefty Frizzell. And then after that, Joan Baez picked it up, the Country Gentleman Bluegrass Band, and there's no telling how many people have performed it. So much so that today, if you perform The Long Black Veil, people think that you're doing a very old traditional song. Mm. But Mary John Wilkin and Danny Dill said, "Oh, there's a market for this. We can write songs as good as their, as the Kingston Trio and these people are performing." And of course, what that overlooks is that country musicians had never stopped doing traditional songs. Merle Travis had a very influential album way back in 1948. That's the album that contained 16 Tons and Dark as the Dungeon, I Am a Pilgrim. And then in the mid-50s, the Louvin brothers, Ira and Charlie, out of Northern Alabama, they put out my favorite album of all time. I think one of the great mm-hmm. albums of country music history, called Tragic Songs of Life. And the song I think we might play right now to illustrate this persistence of tradition was a song called Mary of the Wild Moor. It's a ballad about a young woman who died out in the cold trying to gain shelter and forgiveness from her father. We don't know for sure why she had left home, but she had a babe in her arms, you know. Mm. And the Louvin brothers got that from the Blue Sky Boys, who had recorded it back in the 1930s. And the Blue Sky Boys got it. Nobody knows. Even older, but that just shows what had happened in country music. This music that had begun with folk roots and with a folk catalog passed that tradition on to successive generations through recordings and through commercial performances. In the very earliest days of country music, a singer might say, like Bradley Kincaid, for example, who's heard in the Ken Burns soundtrack doing Barbara Allen, Kincaid probably learned that from his mother or from some old-timer that he knew. Later generations, though, learned it from Bradley Kincaid. And then the people who made their own recordings, then they influenced somebody else that came down the line. So a commercialized tradition of folk transmission had begun, I think, probably still exists today.
Well, it's interesting you should say that, because as I was watching the beginning of and it actually sprinkled throughout the documentary, musicians that are clearly within the country, again, what we think of as the country genre, but we play frequently on Simply Folk. And I'm thinking of somebody like Rhiannon Giddens or the Old Crow Medicine Show. Mm-hmm. It's just so those lines, in many ways, I think of it as more as American roots music than necessary specific genres within that. But those lines are becoming sort of blurred again. We're not necessarily.
Yeah, to me, that's a very healthy thing that these younger musicians are. Recognizing the importance and beauty of American roots music, wherever it came from, whether it's from the blues or gospel or hillbilly tradition, making it their own and giving new life to this music. We just heard Rhiannon singing Wayfaring Strangers just about a week ago, I believe, down at the Stoughton Opera House. Yeah. And it just makes my heart warm to see that happen.
Is that where you see, as you sort of look down the road and think about where the music is going now, can you sort of see into the future? What do you think?
I don't think that the music will sound like it did in the past. Moldy figs, like I am sometime, would like to see the old body of music and not only preserved but transmitted in the future, sounding like it used to. But that's just wishful thinking. That's not going to happen. The music's not going to live unless these younger performers not only preserve it, but they give new life to it through their own performances.
Mm. One thing I want to ask you about is. It seems like bluegrass, and I'm a bluegrass fan, it seems like bluegrass occupies an interesting spot in this mix because it has roots, obviously, in the same roots as country music. It's oftentimes,
well,
if
in
not
the beginning,
today,
it was country music.
Right. I was going to say, there wasn't a distinction. Right. It was country music at the beginning, but now it's sort of branched off to its own subgenre or its own genre, depending on how you look at it.
there's that whole acoustic movement. Yep. People like Sam Bush and Bela Fleck of using traditional bluegrass instruments, but they've gone way out beyond rock and roll and into classical and wherever their interests take them.
Yeah, and it's almost like there's country music that has bluegrass present in it. There's folk music that has bluegrass present, and then there's just bluegrass. You can go to any of these festivals, and you're going to run across that type of that style of music.
And another consequence of this urban folk music revival that we referred to earlier was the nationalization of bluegrass music. Until that time, bluegrass was almost exclusively a Southern working class phenomenon. You go back and look at the biographies of people like Bill Monroe and Lester Flatt and Earl Scruggs and Jim and Jesse McReynolds. They all came out of the South and out of working class backgrounds. But the music reached out to people everywhere, particularly through that sensational form of three-finger banjo playing done by Earl Scruggs. But then in the late 50s, Mike Seeger, who had an interest in both traditional folk music through his family and in bluegrass music, he and his friends started taking that music to college campuses. He was the first person to record the bluegrass musicians from the South. And I've heard it said, I've never documented this, that an album he did in about 1959 called Mountain Music Bluegrass Style for the Folkways label was the very first bluegrass album. And that was recorded in New York. And just the fact that it was recorded in New York by the prestigious Folkways label, you know, gave the music legitimacy. And young musicians began to take it up. You began to hear the Scruggs-style banjo played in Greenwich Village in New York and at the Washington Square, where so many of the folk musicians congregated. And then about that time, Alan Lomax, the famous folklorist, wrote an article for Esquire magazine where he called bluegrass folk music with overdrive. That's a good description of it.
Yeah.
And that's another form of validity. So then after this point, you know, no longer could bluegrass be identified exclusively with its Southern working class roots. Now it was being performed by bands from coast to coast and on college campuses everywhere. And the example of that I pulled out was that of Ralph and Carter Stanley. They were always my favorite bluegrass band, and I think they're favorites to a lot of people because not only did they have that raw country sound, but they had a repertoire that dated back, in many cases, back to the 19th century, if not earlier. And I think that's one reason why they were so popular on college campuses, because they seemed to be the real thing. This is not the Kingston Trio. These are the real folk from which this music was borrowed. And so I think a good example that we could play would be them doing an old prison song of unknown authorship called The Hills of Roan County, about a fellow who killed his brother-in-law through some dispute, then went to prison. And while he was there, somebody in a nearby cell wrote down the words to the story. And in fact, there's an intriguing line right toward the end of the song. It says, "Boys, when you ride home from this dirty old prison, put one of my songs in your letter for me." one of my favorite lines.
That
Hills
is good.
Of Roan County.
That is good. Well, Bill, thank you very much
your
time. It's been great having you here and enjoyed so much the conversation and learning even more about the music that we all love.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah.